Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have Scott Forgy on the show with us. Now, Scott's kind of a... Not kind of. Actually, he's a very interesting dude. He has led... He thinks that's funny. You are an interesting dude, my friend. He has led transformational programs for over 100,000 people. That's right. 100,000 people all over the world. Has coached top executives from all fields. Award-winning architects, designers, Oscar and Tony-winning actors. He has worked with Grammy Award-winning musicians and composers. He has worked with athletes from the NBA, NFL, and Formula One. Hello, John Malone and Liberty Media. Renowned chefs and tech startup geniuses. His practice brings together in-depth thinking from Silicon Valley with the wisdom and practices of advanced consciousness development, which you'll have to explain a little bit about what you mean by that. He has, having teams and groups operate as un or one. Is it un or un? How do you say that?
Un.
Okay, got it right the first time. Yeah. Provides the power to solve nearly every issue in business and in life. He's worked from all, from established enterprises to startups, both corporate and creative. His practice includes one-on-one executive coaching, robust team formation and coaching, larger group issue-specific workshops, skills and performance masterclasses, and agile, scrum, lean, and how do you say that? K-A-N-B-A-N methodologies.
Well, it's actually Kanban, but for most of us in America, we just call it Kanban.
Kanban. That sounds very Midwest. Kanban. Do you have an apple? Do you have an apple? Can I get an apple? As well as tribal leadership, which is how we connected over through John King, who's been on the show twice now. His practice is based in Silicon Valley, but works both nationally and internationally, in person and virtually. And then in his spare time, he comes on cool podcasts and hopefully doesn't get scared off after the first time. So welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show.
I hope I did not butcher your bio there.
No, it was incredible. Now I've got something I have to live up to.
Mm. Well, if you talk a big game, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, as they say, talk isn't cheap, but people cheapen their talk.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, do you want to know a little bit about this? You paused at the consciousness thing.
Yeah.
You want to know a little bit about that and how that works?
I would, because it sounds a little weird in the context of business. So what do you mean by that?
Well, there's a whole conscious capitalism movement that's out there that was started by John Mackey and talking about conscious companies and companies that are self-aware, that are responsible for how they treat people both internally and externally, and all the stakeholders of a company, which would include customers, clients, vendors, everything. And being self-aware and having a sense of what are we committed to and how do we treat people. And that's kind of the business end of it. But my journey to the world of consciousness, like as an expert, really started very early as a judo player. At 10 years old, I remember working with a judo master who was a Zen master. And as a little kid, I thought it was kind of odd. He had to sit down and close our eyes for 10 minutes before we fought. We loved the wrestling part. But there was this great little moment in one of these fights that we did where I threw some kid up over my head in the middle of the air. And in that moment, it was like time stopped. Everything stopped. And I could see him going over and I had the thought, wow, I wonder how this is happening. I wonder how this will end. And that moment of time dilation was my first real experience consciously of the space we like to call flow. And after that kid finally hit the ground and I won the match and I looked at my sensei, the Zen master, I said, what was that? And he looked at me and he knew just what I was saying. And he went, oh, Soto Gari. And
what does that mean?
That was the name of the throw.
Is it Soto Gari like that?
Oh, Soto Gari.
Oh, Soto Gari.
Yeah, I said it just like that, too, just like in a movie. Ah, Osoto Gari.
Sounds like Karate Kid.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like Miyagi. That. He was a very old guy in a white gi with a black belt. It was just like Mr. Miyagi. And when he said that, I knew he was saying the name of the throw, and we all knew the name of the throw. But there was that twinkle in his eye, like, you've identified something powerful and important, and I know you knew it. And it was the first time where I recognized, wait a minute, there's this phenomenon that happened right there. I want to have that as much as I can. And, you know, Mihai called that flow. And right. So we all think of it as being in the zone or flow now, and there's lots written about business. So as I went into in high school, I kind of quit high school my sophomore year, and I started writing code back in the 70s. And we would be at the computer center at 3 a.m. fixing bugs, and you'd look up and go, oh my God, it's 3 a.m. And the police come in and go, your parents are looking for you. We didn't have cell phones then. Yeah. And I was like, you just didn't even notice it. 20 hours went by and you're just fixing bugs and writing code. And it's that same phenomenon of total immersion, perfection, time disappears, you're absorbed into it. And I was like, okay, I want to study this. I want to know what this is about. And that led me through the next 30 years of very intensive inquiry, from Hinduism to Buddhism to religion, philosophy, becoming a martial artist, writing more code, ultimately leading programs for hundreds of thousands of people about what is this thing called consciousness and awareness. And most importantly, how can we perform from the envelope of highest performance, and what gets in the way of that? Because it's a very natural state.
So, you're
so that's kind of,
I think, what my life's, I almost wonder if your interest in coding is not actually that different from your interest in all that transformational work you talked about. It's almost like understanding algorithms and root causes of what's behind things. Is that right? Like, you wanted to go past print hello world, and you want to go, okay, what makes up this operating system, right?
That's exactly right. It's like, you know, when I talk to people who learn to write code now, they're like, I went to a coding camp and, you know, 10 weeks I can write Python. What did you do? And I'm like, well, when I was a
junior,
built
Python.
we built our own assembler, and right. We were doing octal, hex, you know, understanding how ASCII 2 works, you know, base 13. We were doing building our own assembler. We were looking at machine language and ones and zeros, bytes and bits. And I can tell you, this is what the computer is actually doing. It's just light switches that are on and off in complex patterns. And that level of understanding what's happening really helped me. Now, of course, I went off to college and then law school, so I forgot about computers for 20 years. So I can't write much code anymore. But at the time, yeah, I was very interested in what's the source of things and how does it really work beyond, like you say, print the world, you know, and all of that stuff. We really wanted to get to the source of why companies work, how people work, why people work together, why people don't work together. What gets between people? How is it people get married and then they hate each other? Or here in Silicon Valley, how is it three guys come up with the greatest idea, and then once it starts to take some root, they want to kill each other? And it's like, what is that about? How did this fall apart? When did the wheels come off? And I've dealt with a lot of companies where, you know, there are three or four founders, and then they gang up and get rid of one. It's like, how does that happen? And then, you know, for shareholders, it's death. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're
playing with the... What I think is cool with you is the fact that you have a background in a lot of VC stuff. I think people could peg you as the excitement comes from the VC stuff, but it's not really the case. You could work with a boring timber company and still find excitement if you're getting into the levers of what makes up the culture, how the people work with each other, which would inherently make that timber company more profitable. And I think I really like that about you, because I find sometimes I'm kind of nauseated with people who had come from the VC world first, where I discover really quickly they don't really have an interest in business or sustainability or, you know, the levers behind the company. They're much more interested in just the story, which is interesting in and of itself, but there's a lot of cool stories out there. And you were always very different. You're like, you're like the Charlie Munger of the VC world. And, I don't think it's a shocker that you're a fan of Charlie Munger and going to the Daily Journal meeting, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't surprise me. Oh man. Cool.
Yeah. And when you talk about like a timber company, you know, that's like kind of the fun things I like to find out is rather than talk about all the business, it's like, why timber?
Right.
What do you love about this? What has you guys work together? What's so cool about it? And underneath it all, there's something. It may not even be about timber, but there's something that's underneath it that has people want to work together and cause things.
Yeah. It's interesting. So you've done some work with PayPal and Google. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Are you comfortable talking a little bit about that on the show? I don't share anything that's obviously you can't disclose, but those are two really interesting companies, and it's cool to know that are you currently working with them or just that you've done work with them in the past?
No, I'm currently working with their, mostly at this point, I'm working with their coaches.
Okay.
And so for PayPal, I'm working with their enterprise agile coaches, agile being a methodology of how you attack problems that are complex, like running software. And not complicated, but complex, which is its own phenomenon.
Sure.
And so I coach a number of enterprise agile coaches that rearrange how people do work and how priorities happen and that kind of work from agile, both at PayPal, but a number of other companies here in the Valley as well, and some banks and some financial houses. A lot of people are moving towards a more agile way of doing business and organizing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it has to do with how quickly you can respond to change. You know, your agility is responding to marketplace change, needs in the marketplace, and doing that quickly. So if you take something like the automobile industry, you know, 20 years ago, it took 7 to 10 years to change a model, come out with a new car, right? A new line was a 7 to 10 year phenomenon. Well, what happened with Tesla is they can do it in 2 or 3 years. So something's happened very quick. In the world of software, we want to get to where we're responding to what the marketplace wants very, very quickly. With companies like Google, they're putting in software and taking out software features, benefits, bug fixes, moment to moment every day, which is, I mean, kind of hard to even imagine how you could do that. But they're so agile, they're responding in real time to what people want and what people don't want and what's useful and what's not and adding new things in. And so very hard for traditional, more hardware-y businesses to do that. But in software, you have instant response. So you're always working on product market fit and time to market when you see things. So that it makes it kind of an interesting, business agility is a very interesting phenomenon.
But you can apply that to more hard asset business. I mean, as you just said, you can apply it to the automobile industry.
Yeah. And that's more about being as like my company, you know, we talk about being one with your customers. You can start to see what they want, but you can also start to anticipate what they want or see where they're looking. And for companies where you're doing hardware, where it takes 2 years to create something, that connection has you at least be ahead of your competition, which only responds after people start buying it. So it gives you more proactive, adaptive way of looking at business as opposed to a responsive way of looking at business.
So go ahead.
We want to be not building, you know, it's kind of like Tesla. We don't want to be building the cars of today. We want to be building the cars that people want tomorrow because there's that lag time between inception, execution and delivery, and a lot can happen in 2 years.
So what would you do with a business that is a little bit more slow paced, right? I mean, if I just look at a lot of the companies that I'm investing in, they're a little bit more slower paced. I wouldn't personally invest in something where I wouldn't even be able to predict what the future would somewhat look like in the next 3 years. How do you apply that to a kind of a boring company like that?
Give me an example of a boring company. It doesn't have to be one you're invested in.
Sure.
But something people know.
Well, here's an industry that's just boring. Okay, well, why don't we just, so we were talking about before, let's say you were looking at a timber company. Or actually, you know what's a real boring company because it takes almost no people to run it? Is a self-storage business. You know, let's say I owned 30 self-storage units, right?
Right. And
there's clearly some customer service going on. Maybe figuring out where to build. What would you do with a business like that? It's really kind of predictable and boring.
Yeah, something like that, you'd be looking forward towards trends in where those things are located, market, what things people value, and also value adds. So you'd want to be in the world of the customer and what they need and anticipating what they need. So there's follow-along products, there's follow-along services, as well as where the new markets are going to be and what serves them. Are they saturated? It's just all about adaptability.
Okay.
How do I adapt to what they're doing currently?
Let me ask something differently then. Are there any businesses where just like if they approach you, you'd be like, yeah, I can't even do anything for you. Like I'm just not a good fit. Like what would you say no to? Is there anything like where you're just like, I can't really add value here?
Yeah, there's probably some. Some of the bigger, well-known hardware, like someone like Intel, there's not a lot you can do. They're optimized for a certain thing. They've got a marketplace. They've got delivery. It's pretty well set in stone. There's not much you're going to do.
Okay.
The only thing that you're going to do is maybe a little taking out a little risk or taking out a few steps in their manufacturing process, okay? Like lean.
Sure.
Now, lean and places like Toyota, really kind of brought lean to the foreground. All of that Kaizens and lean is just about, taking waste and having things go quicker, faster, marginal improvements. That's all good. If you take something like a financial house, how agility is making a difference there is more internally rather than customer facing. So we're looking at being more innovative by bringing more people to the conversation rather than having a top-down idea.
Okay.
So a top-down idea would be something like an architect designs a building, and then they hand over the plans, and then they render the plans into blueprints, they hand them to people and say, go buy 4 million board feet, cut it this way, assemble it this way. So if you're on the bottom of that, you don't really have a lot to say about how it's going.
Right.
The problem is, in a lot of things, there's sufficient complexity that the people that are on the that are people that are meeting the customer or dealing with it at the level of where the value actually gets delivered have a lot to say about what's going on. And so you can rearrange companies so that there's very, very quick feedback loops. And that's what creates the agility. So it's more of an internal phenomenon. And that's where a lot of innovation comes from, is the people who are building the cars or the people who are building the buildings or talking to the customers. Those needs and those concerns, when they bubble up, become the essence of innovation. Mm-hmm. And if you tell people to just shut up and do your job, well, you've fundamentally killed off any chance of any innovation, which means you're only going to write out the certain product market fit you have in the delivery model.
And what do you do to get people to trust that process, right? If you're a CEO and maybe you even have a very good reputation as being a good operator, what has someone say, hey, I'm good at my job, but I'm going to entrust other people who are not going to do as well as I can?
That's
really, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, it's really tough. And especially when there's a little bit of fear in the air, blood in the water makes the sharks come. And so people get more and more afraid and more frantic. And what people do when they get afraid is they do whatever they've done in the past that works. And if they're effective, they tend to say things like, I know what it's my favorite thing that executives say. It just slays me every time. They'll look at me and they all get that face and you go, here it comes. Here comes the lecture. And they go, look, it's just an execution issue. You need to know what you're doing and just do it. Just execute. It's simple. Execute. Rule one is it's an execution issue. But from the top, it just seems obvious.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, I'm sure it does look like that. But in reality, it's never an execution issue.
So this is where the consciousness stuff comes in. right? Because they're just unconscious to what's going on. They can see the execution, but there's all the stuff that they're blind to. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly it. You can see the feedback, which is, wow, we're not doing well or selling well, or we have a lot of problems. But the source of it is never, we have a lot of problems. No, that's the problem.
Right.
Okay, people aren't buying our goods. Well, we need to get people to buy our goods. Yeah, I know. That's the problem, not the solution. So people have this feedback loop when they're not conscious and scared of saying, here's the problem, it's the problem, and it's the solution. Well, people aren't executing. Okay, so they need to execute. Okay, can I play that back to you? Do you know you just said, here's the problem, it's the problem, now it's the problem, right? And they're like, but they just need to execute. It's like, wow. And then what you find is all of this pressure. As a former CEO of a publicly traded company, I can tell you, there's a lot of pressure.
You were a CEO of a public company?
Yeah, I took a company public.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
What company
called Vigilant. It was legal software.
Huh.
Yeah, it ultimately fizzled out because we didn't anticipate some of the regulatory upsets. Actually, the regulation was fine. It's just people were like, I'm not sure you can do this nationally. And we were like, yeah, you can. So we were going to be the H&R Block of a particular type of federal law, financial law. And we never got it. You know, we got it, took it public, raised a bunch of money, but it never actually took off. So, you know, I had to file those reports every quarter and I had to sign them and do all of that stuff. And I understand the pressure of having to account to shareholders and, you know, but you can't turn around and go, we're not executing, we need to execute. It's
right.
Like silly, because the issue isn't we're not executing. That's the problem. The question is, why not?
What did you learn from that, from running that business that fizzled out?
What did I learn? How many hours do you have? What I learned is one of the things you learn in the world of lean startup, which is always test your riskiest assumptions first.
Yeah.
And then and second of all, test them with other people. So for me, I'm a former trial lawyer, and a bunch of us lawyers, we were like, yeah, this is really simple. We understand it. But as we went into the business world, they were like, oh, we're not so sure you can do this with regulation. And all of a sudden, there was a moment where we realized this wasn't really it was an assumption for us that people would get it, and it wasn't for every lawyer. A lot of lawyers were like, we're too scared, we're too afraid. Well, what if the state says we can't do this? Now, they do it all the time with personal injury, mesothelioma, all that other stuff. There's big national law firms that refer out. But in financial law, nope, there's none. Still aren't.
So if you had to do it again, would the answer just be that you wouldn't have done it?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
I think in the current financial climate and the current regulatory climate, and with lawyers in general being scared to death, I wouldn't do it again. I think, you know, somebody said to me, one of the big questions of investment when you're going to build something, is this an idea whose time has come? And the answer would be no, not yet.
Yeah.
Now, if you take TurboTax, right, that's a federal thing, tax, that has a state component, state tax, and they put it into a software and they have accounting firm, you know, you can get your, now they're advertising, you can get your own accountant on the phone or an accountant for them. But in the world of financial law, in the world of bankruptcy, you can't do that. They just won't let it happen.
It's a tough predicament for people who I think are naturally creative and innovative. You know, my grandfather, I think he died pretty poor, and he actually invented kosher Chinese food.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it didn't take off.
Well, that would be brilliant.
He was someone who, I never met him, but my mom would talk about her father. He was someone who was just like one of these guys who I'm sure I would have loved. I'm sure would be all into this conversation that we're having right now. The guy was like, you know, he started his own like a record label. He created kosher Chinese food, and then like no one was interested. He did like all this crazy shit where he was going to China to like for business stuff when like people weren't going to China. Like,
wow. Kind of,
he got it, and then he like got himself adopted by a family in China or something. The guy was like wild. But yeah, he ended up, I'm not gonna go too far into this, but he had actually, he had a piece of art that he donated to, I want to say it was the Met, but we have a thing, my parents' house in New York, they have like a thing that's like a thank you for donating this piece of art. Now again, this guy died poor. That piece of art today is worth like over $1 million.
Wow.
And he just, you know, he knew the artist and just kind of gave it away, and
yeah,
that's who he was, you know?
Yeah. That's kind of the unfortunate nature of innovation and having, you know, foresight and everything. Yeah. You know, it reminds me, I was in Berkeley at one of the companies that's a startup that I'm coaching. And I saw somebody had out on the front porch, they had like a blackboard, little kids like blackboard, and it was out there. It's just a little place in Berkeley. It's so gentrified now, it's sick. But it said, the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese.
Yeah.
And it's kind of been a little bit of my experience sometime in the world of people who are very prophetic and see the future and future needs is that's kind of what I learned from that whole thing, is you have to ask yourself, is this an idea whose time has come? Because if you're too far ahead of the wave, everybody's like, what's the deal? And then 10 years later, it's like, oh yeah, I'd already invented that.
Well, so, as they say in the value investing community, it's not necessarily advantageous to be the first mover, but to be the person that takes advantage of the first mover.
Yeah.
You know, you look, and actually, I know we were talking earlier off this about John Malone, but he's like a perfect example of someone who just invests as little as possible into into technology around like phone systems and stuff like that. Let other people do all the innovating. And then as the price comes down and as there's like overcapacity, then he'll come in and buy assets cheap and be able to just, instead of, he didn't ever have to spend all this R&D on technology because he let other companies do it for him.
That's really smart. That's a really smart strategy.
And you know, people would get annoyed, and people get annoyed by people who are like, oh, well, they're not investing enough in research and development. They're not doing anything to help the shareholders. It's like, well, no, that actually is helping the shareholders by not doing research and development right now. Let other people waste the capital.
Yeah, that's
exactly. Let other people run their business like a nonprofit or like a charity.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a good balance to that too, because
of course,
if you look,
of course,
like when I was at PayPal,
Tesla is an example of a good balance. Like Tesla could easily be worth zero. Like that.
Yeah.
Like that equity could be worth nothing in 2 years from now, potentially. Could be worth a lot. Who knows? I mean, he has to keep pulling rabbits out of his hat. But you know, I think that's a perfect example where like Elon Musk, I think is a very brilliant guy, and like we need Elon Musk. But then at the same time, the guy is kind of a scum. I personally find him kind of a scumbag, and that he isn't always the most ethical with how he markets what he's going to do. And then I almost wonder if it's if he has, I don't want to say suffers from, because it could be advantageous too depending on how you look at it, but he has that like reality distortion field that Steve Jobs had, where he's trying to bend reality so much that if something doesn't work out, then you go, oh, he lied. But if it works out, then you go, he's a genius.
Yeah,
it's kind of a very fine line.
Yeah, genius and idiot are only clear in retrospect.
I think genius and scumbag are also clear in retrospect. I mean, could you imagine if Steve Jobs failed the second time around when he came back to Apple and he still failed? We would look at Steve Jobs as a moron today.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that strategy, letting other people innovate and then taking advantage of it, is really, if you look at some of the biggest companies here, from Microsoft to when I was at PayPal, you know, we had a big enough chunk of cash sitting around, just like Apple does and Microsoft does, that look and see who's innovating and getting traction, and then acquire that company and their technology. And that's how, you know, if you look at, people think of Microsoft Office. Wow, Microsoft came up with that. Well, you want to back up a little bit. That's an accumulation of things they bought and then had worked together as one seamless suite.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember when they bought Visio, and you know, most people, you know, broke their pick on Visio. It's not the easiest program to operate, but it, that was a standalone independent company. And now they've bought, you know, Skype, and it is definitely better for it. Mm-hmm. It's phenomenal, reliable. It's way better. But it, what we've seen is a lot of these companies, once they get at scale, it makes much more sense for a variety of different reasons. One, we were talking about offline. It makes a lot more sense to be the platform or the stable platform inside of which you can bring innovative things in. Yeah. But most companies at scale just do a horrible job at innovation. Like, tragic.
How do you,
like, you know, how do you think of a new product that Visa's come up with in the last 3 years? I mean, you know, about your credit card, well, it doesn't look any different or operate different.
Visa's in some competitive bidding war, I think, right now to buy some company or technology. They do that quite a bit.
Yeah. You know, I mean, why not? When you're making, you know, when you're making $20 billion a quarter on 850 lines of code, the only thing to do is make sure the code runs.
Yeah.
That's it.
Right. I mean, Visa's still a wonderful company.
I mean, their TPV is insane. Nobody's ever going to catch them. They get too far of a lead. And you take the top three or top four, they've just got such a big lead, and the barrier to marketplace entry is so high that they can run those 850 lines of code for the next 20 years and continue to bring the money in. And they could shutter most of their offices in Foster City because I'm not sure what the hell they're doing. Something with the money.
Scott, how do you... Because you're clearly working with some large companies, and you've worked with large businesses in the past. And you said one of the things you do is help them stay innovative. How do you prevent innovation kind of from disappearing down a black hole with these large companies that end up, right? Because obviously startups are innovative by default, but then as systems and processes come in, some of that gets killed off. How have you worked with businesses to actually stay innovative while also still having certain kinds of processes and all that? You get what I'm saying? I don't know how to ask this question properly.
The problem is you got like four questions.
Yeah.
There. Yeah. So startups have to innovate or do something, right? And there's certain things that are just wonderfully built in when you got six guys working in a garage that you don't have when you have a campus of 20,000 people.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, there's ways to look at that for why does innovation stagnate in the enterprise scale companies, no matter what they do. I mean, you know, we now I got to think of NDAs and what I can talk about. I've had a number of very large companies from Japan come and say, we need an innovation center. We need to innovate. We need entrepreneurship. And then they send people and they go, OK, tell us how to innovate so we can innovate. Like, oh my, okay, yeah, this is going to go well. And, you know, and the other model is like the Adobe model where, you know, a couple guys that we played with, where they just go rogue inside the company. Like one of their favorite thing is this kickbox, which is like a kickbox starter thing where they'll give anybody in the company $1,000 on a debit card and just go wild with your innovation and let us know if it turns out, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I talked to the guy that started, he goes, oh, yeah, I was fired like four times and I just don't go away. And they just can't get rid of me. And I was like, how does that work? Well, I had my own budget and I stole it from here. And you kind of go, wait a minute, you're just completely rogue inside of a big company. And he's like, yeah, in a big company, it's easy to hide and still have money coming in.
Right.
And I was like, wow, okay, that's probably not a sustainable model for innovation.
No.
And he was like, yeah, I know, they fired me like four times. And I was like, all right, well, how about we not replicate that? you know, the joke about the innovation tends to be like you get all these corporate people and you say, okay, we're all going to innovate. And it's that thing when we say we're all individuals, everybody at the same time, we're all individuals. And then you get the joke is it doesn't work quite like that. So what we like to do, and if you look at the life cycle of a company, is one way to look at it. But for your listeners and the people that are there, they're probably not building companies. They're probably investing in companies.
Yeah, right? It's the Intelligent Investing Podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting. It always blows my mind who's listening. Because I get emails quite often of, hey, I saw your show and, you know, blah, 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 blah. They have a question for me and we get in a little conversation. Oh, what do you do? And it's just like, oh, I'm the CEO of this firm. Like, why do you listen to my show? It's like, oh, I had a guy call me. I've had people reach out to me from like different countries and stuff too. It's very cool, the kinds of people. I'm not going to disclose anyone's information, but it's kind of amazing, like the kinds of people that have reached out to me through this show. It's actually awesome.
Awesome.
So thank you for all you amazing listeners that I would never even think you were my target audience, and you listen anyway. So it's very cool.
I think that's the coolest thing about the internet is that although there's a lot of noise out there, it's access. Anybody who runs across this and goes, my God, this is a lively, fun conversation. I can participate. Yeah. They can just do it. They don't have to have permission from NBC or CBS. They can just choose themselves. I love that aspect of it.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the great things about the web. You know, there's more diversity and more intelligence out there now.
Yes.
So to answer your question for your listeners, one of my dear friends, Ron Lichty, who's one of the original consultants around the app world and software fellow code writer, he wrote a book where he talked about software engineers and disclosed the real truth about it, which is most people think of those people as engineers and they think of themselves as artists. Their art is software.
Yeah.
So as we started looking at this and looking at companies and say, well, how do we take this apart in a way that's meaningful, that we can see what are the forces that are running a company that cause some companies to want to really innovate and do a great job and other companies not innovate at all and kill off any innovation no matter what happens. And there's companies like that. You get an innovation? Great, we'll kill it. And, you know, that's kind of how it goes. So what we looked at is in a non-rigorous way, you could say, what do people care about? What's their core thing that they care about? Heidegger called them concerns. What are people concerned for? Now, the problem with concerns is people hear concerns and they hear concerns and they go, oh, what am I worried about?
Yeah, what are you worried about?
Yeah, worried about it's not really what's going on with people. Although the worry creates, you know, the moment people get threatened, they worry and have fear and then their brains fall out, right?
But even then, there's some kind of commitment behind why they're getting worried.
Well, yeah, they're committed to something positive, like their company running and employing people or something. But the moment something gets threatened, their brains fall out. And then what you have is the threatened person. And, you know, God knows you get the worst of people when their brains fall out. It's kind of like we say that concerns are if you think of someone walking across a tightrope. I don't know if you saw that wonderful movie that they did about the guy that walked across the tightrope between the Twin Towers.
What's it called?
I wish I knew the answer.
I want to say I've seen that, though. It's like a clip of that or something online.
It's a really well done movie. I can't think of his name who did it, but this guy walks on a wire between the Twin Towers of World Trade Center.
Okay.
It's a little wacky. And so he's got a concern for, you know, walking and balancing and things. Okay. Now he's not worried about falling, because if you stare at falling and worrying about falling, it doesn't make you walk any better. So you have a concern for grip, you have a concern for balance, you have a concern for that.
So I feel like it would make you walk worse. If you look at businesses, right, where there's so many case studies. I don't even know where I would start with this, but generally businesses that are kind of like going through the motions and aren't really like, hey, let's take a step back and see like why we're doing what we're doing. The moment like shit hits the fan, it's let's do cost cutting and we're going to be in as much survival as possible. And what's amazing is like, okay, you're in an environment right now where every other one of your competitors is now getting weaker. Why the hell are you getting rid of people and stopping innovation? This is your opportunity to innovate and destroy your competition, and they do the opposite time and time again. And it's just like, wow.
Yeah. I just have a company right now that I get asked to coach, and they just went through where they lost two founders and reduced their headcount by 30%. You know, it's only a company with 100 people or so.
Yep.
And it's like, why did you do that? What were you thinking? Is it going to cut costs?
But you know it. Sure. You know what they were thinking.
Yeah, you know we got to cut costs thinking. And make everybody happy or else we're out of business.
Right.
And it's like, no, that's what the people do. What the bold people do is go, okay, we got to chart a new course, right? But
well, I think people don't have a strong muscle in that. Like, it's like, well, I can't start and chart a new course if I don't have the money to do it. All right, you'll have people with their justifications of why they can't do it.
Yeah, it's circular logic.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's the logic of threat and fear. No one has ever saved themselves into prosperity and market product fit. Now, cutting costs and cutting risks does not increase product market fit or innovation.
Right.
Those are two different things. So if you're at scale, right, mm-hmm. that's the kind of thing you'd want to do. Wow, we've got product market fit. Let's optimize for profitability. Perfect thing to do when you have product market fit. And you might want to innovate because it's dynamic, not static. But if you have something like Visa where your product market fits like 100%, sure, you'd want to optimize, reduce costs, reduce risk. The problem is, like you said, those companies that are right now enduring a product market challenge, last thing you want to do is optimize for profitability. Why? Because you'll be out of business.
So yeah.
That's the time you need to go, wait a minute. What are we doing and who's our customer and why did they just heave us ho and where could we go? Those are the deep conversations people don't have. Instead, they send out a memo. Everybody's got to take a haircut. It's my favorite phrase. We got to take a haircut here. Could you give me non-McKinsey jargon for that? Yes. Pick the worst 10 people, take them out and have them shot. Okay, now I can get it. And it's just like ludicrous. And they do that across... You know, Sun was famous for every Friday there would be, you know, another 5,000 firings for years. They just fire people as a way to, you know, and that it's in it, we're I'm a pilot. One of the things you learn as a pilot and a sailor, especially sailing, is you don't follow the compass. Otherwise, you just go back and forth and back and forth. And people are staring at a spreadsheet rather than looking out into the marketplace. And the spreadsheets are informative, but as a pilot, you can't fly according to the compass. It'll kill you. You want to anticipate. So yeah, that's that whipsaw kind of response and reactive way of thinking will kill a business quicker than anything.
Well, but thank God no one's ever flown with me while I was the pilot. I've never flown an airplane, but I would.
Oh,
but if I stepped into an airplane, I probably would just follow the compass. Yeah, it wouldn't be a good outcome, I guess.
It's kind of funny. Because there's just a touch of lag, too. And we call it pilot stop oscillation, PIO. And it's kind of funny. You know, like when you're driving a car and it starts the fishtail and you go one way, then the other, then it gets worse and worse and worse. It does that like times 20 in a plane.
Oh, interesting.
And so you can get a really bad feedback loop and do some really bad things like, you know, JFK Jr., you know, put it in the water. Yeah, it's not good. You don't want to do that.
No.
And companies do the same thing. They react to something, and they react. And a lot of times with CEOs, I talk about what we call a graveyard spin or a death spiral, which is a very logical set of actions and reactions that ultimately leads to your death. And people take them intelligently, and they're just reacting to what's happening. And at some point, the plane goes into a spiral and kills you. And it's like, well, you know, don't do that. There's ways around that. You want to think about this. And it's very intuitive, too, because once you start turning left and then you straighten up, you feel like now you're turning right. So you go, oh, my God, my inner ear says we're turning right. Well, I need to level out. So now you're turning left. It's just a matter of time till you're dead.
Huh.
And that's exactly what companies do, too, is they go by their experience and what's happening rather than reading the really important things like product market fit, what the customer thinks, where the market's headed, those kind of things. And that kind of feedback comes from the ground and from the customers. It doesn't come from a spreadsheet, although spreadsheets are useful.
So can you give me an example, like with Google, like in a, like a real...
Oh, they pulled up.
What's that?
Let's see. Who can I talk about with an example? Well, yeah, sure, with Google.
Yeah.
Here's a good example. They just sent out something to everyone saying, our Google Suite for all the people that use their Google Suite for email addresses and their email suite for companies is now changing. Because yep. what they've seen over a period of time is people haven't used certain features.
I got that email.
And it would be, yeah, and it would be easier to merge these features, and now we're going to call it this, and it's going to be much more intuitive. So that's an example of people using both data and data derived from customers and usage rather than, you know, plowing ahead and then all of a sudden looking at, wow, people weren't using it anymore. Good. We've got to make people use it. You know, they're dealing with why people weren't using things and can we make it more intuitive or do we need to ditch it? So there's a good example right there.
Interesting. Huh.
What are, neat,
what,
eh?
Yeah. What are other ways for, you know, let's say someone was running a large company and they get what you're saying. I think this is the struggle for a lot of people who are very grounded in business and financials, which obviously at the end of the day do matter.
Sure.
Is how do you know, I'm even trying to put myself in that perspective, right? I've been in a company for 20 years, I've built up this business as something really large. I think I'm pretty good at what I do. And now I want to keep innovating and I don't want, you know, like I want to optimize my profits and, but I also want to keep innovating. And it, you know, if I was bringing you in, what are the kinds of things you would look at? You know, cause I think what you talk about is for probably most people is easy to get intellectually, but then mm-hmm. they might say, well, he's being a little vague. Does it really work in reality? You know, like that kind of thing. If they've never experienced working with someone like you before, what would you say to someone like that? Like if you were to describe your process a little bit more?
Well, you know, it's really great. It starts with what people are committed to.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so if you have a company and they say, well, we want to innovate, the first question is why? Why in God's name would you want to innovate? What are you thinking?
Yeah.
And is it appropriate for your company? I mean, do you need to just, are you sundowning? Do you need to just optimize for profit and ride this sucker out? What's the need to innovate? You know, maybe this thing's going to ride for so long. I mean, some of the companies that are around that are huge, most of them haven't been around 15 years ago. So there's a lot, the velocity of things becoming obsolete or disappearing is quite alarming.
And what about a declining business? Like, let's say you're running a business, right? And
oh, yeah,
it's in decline. Let's say you were running a beeper company, right? Or I had a buddy of mine who his dad owned a typewriter company and had amazing mm-hmm. margins, right? I mean, it's declining revenue every year, but wonderful margins.
Ooh.
Would you I mean, you know, he made a lot of money on a declining business.
There's money to be made. Then.
Of course, yeah. You're talking with a value investor. I love buying shitty companies that are in decline, actually.
That's great. It's all part of the business.
But my question is, if I was being an activist with a company like that, not just seeing it as a... Mm. Right, if I'm looking at it as a passive investment, I'm just looking at it as, okay, how much money do I think is going to come out of this company before it goes to zero? Right, which you can make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. If you were the CEO of a declining business, now maybe there isn't a general answer, but are you looking to sort of just help navigate the ship and make it as effective as possible while it's in decline with the acknowledgement it will go to zero, but I'll make some money along the way? Or are you looking to actually grow new lines of business so you're managing the declining business while building new stuff at the same time? Or is there no right answer and it's case by case?
Well, I think the answer is, like you said, it's case by case. It has a lot to do with the constitution of the people involved.
Right.
Right. Okay. So sometimes people are like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, frequently you'll hear the McKinsey speak called it sundowning or sunsetting.
Okay.
Yeah, technology is sunsetting. So the question is, how much money can we make until nobody uses it anymore?
Right.
And I know people who are, one of my dear friends, Peter Fitkowski, is runs a company that helps with software on machines that were designed to make computer chips or designed to do things that are 5 years old and older.
Yeah.
So they're still useful for 10 years, but they're sundowning.
Okay.
And there'll be a point where they just, you know, chuck them. But from now for 10 years, there's money to be made on the software that runs them. And so, yeah, there's a lot of money to be made in that world. And sometimes they're just like, we just want to do that. But for people who go, wait a second, I don't want to be at the helm of a sinking ship and save as many people as possible, which is sometimes how it occurs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to do. One of the companies that I consulted with a few years ago is a very large player in the fitness industry. And in the last 5 or 6 years, the fitness industry has shifted magically big, like huge magnitude change, inroads where they're losing 15 to 20% a year, which for any industry at scale, that's like frightening, right? There goes all your profit.
Right.
And the business model is shifting. And so the way to approach those kind of companies is to actually look at what is the core value prop? Why did we get into this business? What value does it generate? What value do people want? You have to go back to building blocks. And that's the source of innovation, is instead of going forward and saying, well, we're going to do a new product. Wait a second. We need to deconstruct, and we need to first see, what are we useful for? Why did people love us? Why did people give us money? And why are people giving us money now? And why are people migrating to another model? You know, one of the things that hurt the big stores was that there's all these little innovative ones that are much higher quality boutique, like SoulCycle is a good example of it. Company went public. They run really, really good spin classes. Super
okay.
good. All right. Like, have you ever been to a SoulCycle?
I have not.
Yeah, it's like empowerment plus spinning all at the same time with music. It's this, you know, super yoga spinning, wonderful, empowering. You get done with that and you're like, wow, I spent $25 for that hour, or $35, but it was the best spinning class I've ever been to.
I've seen people walking out of spin classes in New York City. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And so then the problem is, everybody goes, well, instead of going to a big box, I'm going to go to one of those because it's specialized. So then you have to start to go, okay, what was my value prop that had me build all these big things?
Yeah.
So there's no way, Eric, to not go and take apart everything at a molecular level back to the fundamentals of commerce. What is it that I'm bringing that people value? What did I bring? What am I bringing? Am I bringing that with integrity? And what do people value? And what are they going to? If you can't take it apart at that level, you have no hope. You just might as well optimize and wait to die, because that's where the innovation is going to come from. And what you find is the kinds of people who like to do that kind of thinking are the kinds of people that run big scale companies.
Yeah.
Okay. They're more like optimizers. So that founder energy, that spark of the CEO of that company was a guy who is a fitness guy. I mean, he's like, we'd have a meeting and I'd say, okay, we're going to meet at 6 a.m. And he'd say, well, I got up at 3 to get my workout in so I could fly here and meet with you. I was like, what? Yeah. Got up at 3. He's like, I'm going to get my workout in. And he climbs mountains. And he just loves fitness. Mark, he's an extraordinary fitness guy. And he just asks me every time I see him, how's the fitness going? How's your trainer? Are you enjoying it? What are you doing? How fast are you running a mile now? That love of the very intimate thing that makes it all work is kind of what his whole life is about. And we like to call that founder energy or founder concerns. He's concerned for the very value at the core of the company, just like hopefully the people that run Coca-Cola, I don't know, I haven't done much work with them. They just love Coke and they really love that. They better, or else it's going to be a real problem.
Well, it's funny. People talk about, I rarely bring up Warren Buffett on the show because it almost becomes like a cliche bringing him up too much, even though I love the guy and he's the reason I got into investing. But it made me think of something where sometimes at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting, you know, Buffett himself acknowledges that he's not the kind of guy that wants to be operating businesses, but him building Berkshire and collecting businesses, like that's his art gallery, essentially, right? Where he brings in all these talented CEOs who can do a much better job than he can at running the business. And Berkshire Hathaway is his canvas, and he keeps filling it up, and he'll keep filling it up until the day he dies, and that's his canvas. That's how he talks about it. But it's interesting that even though he's running, or he's kind of over, it's not really running it, but he's overseeing such a large organization, and he's really just doing he does some running, but it's the helping with the culture and keeping the investments going. But he's pretty hands off for the most part. But what's interesting is that occasionally someone will ask him about something, and all of a sudden he'll go into like the sales per square feet in February of Nebraska Furniture Mart, and then he'll go on this whole thing about how brilliant, you know, Rose Blumkin, the founder, was, and then he'll talk about how that connects to See's Candies, and then when he invested in Apple, he saw that same thing from Nebraska Furniture Mart, and he starts hyperventilating with how he literally will start hyperventilating on stage with how excited he gets about these like just benign little things, and then somehow he'll talk about in 1907 there was some dam in Arkansas, and it's like, what the fuck? How did you just go from that to that? Like, wow. But that's the kind of passion he has for just understanding business. And Charlie Munger has a passion for taking principles from different industries and different kinds of disciplines, rather, and synthesizing them together. That's his big thing.
Yeah, mental models and how they fit together.
Yeah. And he's a true polymath. And but he loves it. And it's just like, he's like, last year at the Daily Journal meeting, he was talking about how psychology is taught all wrong in school, and that psychology could only be understood through the lens of another discipline. But if you learn psychology in and of itself, it's useless. And loves that stuff. And I actually get it, right? Because it's and then some people just they built a company doing X, and all they care about is X, and that's their thing.
Yeah. And then, that's exactly right. That founder energy, that kind of, there's something about this they care about. It may be like, I just love scaling. I love to see something take root and take form.
Yeah.
I work with a branding company, and there's like, they did, one of my branding companies I work with did Jägermeister. Okay. And they're like, this stuff tastes like crap.
I think it's good.
I just love it. Really? Oh, it's horrible. Like it. but it's like, I love when something really goes well and people take it up, and I love that. And I was like, okay. He said, I don't really care what the product is. I like causing that. But it's knowing what you love to cause out in the world. And so when I've set panels with, some of the VC legends like Bill Reichert and Chris Yeh and Steve Bird, and they all say the same thing. There's this thing they're looking for, which is they're in love with their team and they're in love with the product, and this is going to happen no matter what because they just love it. He said, that's what we invest in. Everything else, you can replicate it. It doesn't matter. If that spark you're talking about, like that Warren Buffett is looking for, that's a very particular spark, and we like to call that founder energy. Those are people that aren't working for a company. Their core statement is, I am the company. I am the value.
So
for him, it was like, I am fitness, that everybody can have experience of the joy of working out that I have. And that's just like who the guy is. Now, he has a lot of, talent, MBA and an accounting background and everything else. But the core spark that he uses all that talent for is very much a founder, which is different than, hire me, I'll come do your spreadsheets. And we call those career concerns. Those are much more like bureaucrats. And those are very opposed things. So if your company is run by people with career concerns, which is not make a career decision, they tend to optimize for stability, they optimize for profit, they optimize for margins, those people are at the opposite of founder energy. And it takes all types and different blends depending on where the company is. But if it's all one and none of the other, you have a problem. All founder energy, they just keep recreating the company every 6 weeks. You never make any money. But all of the career concerns, they just want to stay stable, and then the company goes right off the cliff at some point because it becomes irrelevant. So it's the portfolio of, you know, and your listeners are great at portfolio thinking. I look at it more like an algorithm or a portfolio of energies, right? And you need certain artist energies, which are artisans about some aspects of it. They could care less whether they're making video games or, you know, communication software, but the meticulousness of the art is what their bag is.
Yeah, so I mean, I can tell you, I think one of the things that I was most attracted to about you when I first met you was, you know, Buffett talks about the importance, and Charlie Munger really actually was the guy that influenced Buffett around this, was the importance of, you know, investing in a business with a competitive moat. And then Buffett always says, you know, he wants his CEOs to be looking at how can I improve our competitive position every single day when you wake up? How can I make us even more competitive than yesterday? And what I love about what you do and the work that you do is you're actually doing that, you know, on the court in real time with people. Because I think everyone obviously says, oh, we want to be more competitive. But it doesn't mean that they actually are.
Yes.
And there have been plenty of businesses, I'm not going to name names, but where they spend a lot of money on, you know, some kind of strategy where the end product is to make them more efficient or more competitive, but it ends up not really having the impact they thought it would have.
Right.
And so I like literally if I was running a holding company and I had a bunch of businesses, I would bring you in just for the sole purpose of helping empower my CEOs become, you know, build their competitive moats even more effectively than they're doing right now. Just that simple thing alone is a value add in my view.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you know, where it's useful is also getting the right CEO. So do I need somebody in, like you said, a sundowning business? You know, business is busy sunsetting and, you know, the prospects are, you know, we're going to ride this one out.
Sure.
Do I need to bring somebody in who's going to breathe new life into it, that can find new avenues, new products, new marketplaces? Or do I need someone who's going to administer it really super well and have it be stable?
Right.
Those kind of decisions are great decisions that, you know, boards and shareholders can make about what they see will make a difference in the future of their investment in their company. So, it's, you know, what's appropriate and right is probably a good thing.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting.
Some people were, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I'm going to say, you know, everybody has their own talent, right? And everybody has their own point of view. And I know people that are great stabilizers. And then I've seen people with startups that are like, you know, a house on fire, and then they go to a big company and bring somebody in and go, ah, this person ran this section of Intel, they should be great for us. And then they trash the whole company, kill the culture, and kill the business. It's like, wow.
Like what happened with Apple.
Yeah, there you go.
That's like the perfect example, like the epitome of it, right?
Yeah.
What was the guy's name who replaced Jobs?
I don't know.
The guy from Pepsi.
They hired him.
There's the guy they hired from Pepsi.
Yeah, yeah. Jobs brought him in and hired him, and then he fired him and took over the company.
Did you ever read the Walter Isaacson book on him, Steve Jobs?
No, I haven't.
It was brilliant. Fantastic book. Yeah. Awesome.
I find some of those people are so mythological, sometimes it's hard to really get a sense of who they are and what they do, like the Elon Musks and those people. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, with smaller companies, with these people that aren't gods, but are really effective and successful, and say, okay, I can relate to these guys. Sure. What is it their genius is, and what are they creating? So, you know, I've had the luxury of being around some of those people, which is kind of neat. You know, they're not household names.
Sure.
But you kind of get a sense of, oh, this is what works.
Well, yeah. Look, there's a lot of guys in the you know, just CEOs of public companies that I really admire that most people have never heard of, but they're people I'm like, wow, like they're, you got to read their shareholder letter. You got to, you know, and I think they're really cool. So I understand that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, so your attraction to tribal leadership, I've actually had John King on the show twice. And we've talked quite a bit about tribal leadership. There's probably over 2 hours worth of content on tribal leadership on this podcast, and I'll put some links in the show notes. But was your attraction to tribal leadership through just your general interest in culture at organizations? Is that how did you come to that?
Yeah, well, funny you should mention that. I come to it because the holy grail, really, in you know the world of companies or anything, is team.
Ultimately, it's team.
If you read any of the work out on Agile, if you read Sapiens or anything, what you find out is, if you look at the military, it's all teams. Teams are 7 ± 2 people. Okay. Ooh. And at the source of everything is teams, small teams, not work groups, teams. And most people, a lot of people have had the experience of being on a championship team. Mm-hmm. But it's surprising when I go talk to people how many people haven't had the experience of actually being on an authentic team. Team is a phenomenon that arises.
I'll stop there. I think what you just said is very important because I think
it is.
The vast majority of people in the finance world, when you say team, it is such a common just like thing that has been so diluted in our language. Like you got to be on a team. We're a team. We're on a sales team. If I didn't know you and you just started talking about team, I would start rolling my eyes and probably tune out. Like that's how disinterested I am in most people talking about teams because it's just like, okay, the guy doesn't get it. You get it. So can you elaborate and just drill down a little bit more on what you mean when you say team compared to a lot of the common vernacular and the common wisdom about what people think a team is compared to what a team actually is?
Yeah, really, really well said, and I really appreciate, Eric, you not glossing over that, because that's one of the biggest jokes there is. They'll probably shoot me, but one of my team of Agile coaches at PayPal, we call Team Pickle Jar, because the distinction is, listen, a jar of 7 ± 2 pickles, even if they're co-located in the same jar, is not a team. They're just pickles in a jar. And so we like to call those work groups. Look, the fact that you put 7 ± 2 people together, you gave them a team name, they have a team color, and they have a place to where the workstations are, and they get together and say, go team.
I worked at a sales organization once where before we started our day, we would like huddle around in some stupid meeting, and we would like do a fucking chant.
Yeah,
if we all knew how bullshit it was, but we all like, but it was at least more fun than actually like acknowledging that we were all just completely individuals competing with each other. So it made it like more. It still made it more fun, but it would have almost been more fun to be like, I'm gonna get more sales than you, and I will take people that you know, I will be ruthless against you, and if you need to get fired over me, I will do it. Like that would have been more interesting in some ways.
Yeah.
We were not on a team.
No, it's not a team. And that's kind of the joke. That's why I've coached so much in like the sports realms is because there are some things you need a team for. You have to have a team. The absence of a team will crush it. So one of the big places where you have to have a team is like my son plays in a woodwind quintet, and the phenomenon of team, if it's not there, there's no Beethoven or Brahms. It's just a mess of squeaks. And so for musicians especially, this phenomenon is a very, very particular thing. Whether you're in a team that's doing any activity, and like I say, you read Sapiens or anything, the units that work are teams, and teams are always 7 ± 2 people. That's all we can have on a team. Otherwise, you need to start to look at having two teams rather than one. And then, you know, John talks about that in his book a lot. I've had the privilege of working with a few SEAL teams as well. And when you've been on a team.
What's that like, working with SEAL teams?
They're really focused.
That's cool.
It's fun. They're really focused. They're very much like sports. They're focused and intense. They're right there with you.
Have you listened to, I feel like now, like there's like a thing. I actually know a lot of current SEALs can't stand this, but there's some like ex-SEALs, they'll go on and like write business management books using the principles they learned. And they're interesting, this is nothing to do with anything, but it just has to do with the intensity. When you listen to the audiobooks of these guys, it's like, it's like, holy shit, dude. Like, hello, my name is this, and I'm going to talk about this business thing. Now, when I'm on the SEALs, and when there is a tragedy, yes, it is sad, but you keep going, and it's like, and they're just like that for 10 hours straight on the audiobook, and I'm like, holy shit.
One of my earlier trainers, when I did this thing called The Forum, by a company called Landmark that I did a lot of work with at some point, was a guy that was head of SEAL Team 1 in Vietnam, Jack Trop.
Oh, interesting.
And I get to know him and be a great friend of his, and he trained me. And I think he has one of those books out. But Jack used to have this stern face, and he'd say, okay, see this? This is happy. This is what happy looks like.
Don't kill me, please.
He was just like, but he had the funniest sense of humor, and he was a hilarious and warm guy, but he was like, you know, it's just straight about things. Like, are you going to step off that curb? And you're like, what? It's like, everything's life or death with him. It's like, Jesus, Jack. But that's the world. So they're really intense. And the thing that they get, or good teams, whether it's basketball or NFL, is the connection is there so that there's nothing between you and the other player. And you experience team as one, not different people playing. It's one team. That's the holy grail of things, is when you get team flow. When that happens, it's magic.
Yeah.
A lot of things can get between you. The difficulty with creating teams is most of the books are additive. Really, to create a team, you have to take everything away. And it's a lot of work.
That's also something I don't want to gloss over, is the idea of taking things away as opposed to adding things. I will say, almost across the board, when I have talked to, I'm just thinking of one guy who worked at HR for a very, very large, multi-billion-dollar organization, and he was like, he was already in the realm of like, what management technique do you do that I haven't learned? And it seems like that's the default conversation, is what do I have to add to my tool set
to make them a team?
Right. Yeah. And it's like, well, actually, what do I have to unbrainwash you from?
Yeah. Yeah. It's getting rid of all this stuff. It's whatever's between people. And it's a, when I did it with a fitness company, we did it with 28 teams at the RVP director and above level, all the way to different teams inside of it. Like, they have one of the greatest group of fitness people that should be a team that weren't. And how you know they're a team is, if a grenade falls in the middle of the room, all of them will try and fall on it. There's no conversation of me versus you. It's just us.
Yeah.
So then what has to happen are all the things that get between people. Your thoughts, your dreams, your opinions, your judgments, your assessments, your fears, your wants, your desires. The desire, like John says very well, to be the star, that's got to go away. But no, but like, really, you, and that's the hardest thing about John's book, Tribal Leadership, is the stage three people are, look at me, I'm great. Yet,
well, the hard thing about that book is the stage three people will read Tribal Leadership and be like, oh, I'm in stage five.
Yeah, and you're not. You're in stage three. You're totally in stage three. In fact, rarely do I meet anyone who's at stage five. Or four, it's all stage three. Look at me. I'm great. And I have a good team in the background is supporting my greatness.
Right. Exactly.
So
be, as John would say, star of supporting cast, right?
Yeah, that is so true. I mean, I see it all the time. We've got a great team and I'm leading them. Yeah. Well, you know,
look
how you know,
talk
you got a great
about our great team.
Yeah. How you know who the leader is on a great team is he the guy in the back that's sitting down. You have stars around you. You have everybody else shine, and it occurs as an ensemble cast.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So, there's a guy who there's a few disagreements I've had with him with management decisions, but overall, I really respect and admire this guy. And He runs a multi-billion dollar public company. It's in the investment banking. I'll leave it at that. But I was emailing with him a few months ago, and I asked him if he wanted to come on the podcast to talk about all, because he was doing a lot of very interesting, innovative stuff. And I was like, I'd love to have you on and talk about it. And he said, I'm going to have to decline. And the reason he gave me why he didn't want to come on the podcast is he said, you know, we have a culture where people are really innovative, and I don't want it to even get perceived like it's becoming about me and I'm the figurehead. And I'm like, wow, that's awesome.
That's great.
He didn't even want the publicity of him being attached to the company, even though he's technically the CEO.
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally get that. And it's not a false sense of humility.
No, not at all. It was like a real preservation. It's like, I want to preserve the culture, and it could do damage to what I've been building if I come on a podcast and it becomes about me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I go, well, you could talk about your team. He goes, no, but I'm the one. He goes, if I'm the one talking about it and they're not, that's the problem.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you see people like in the NFL, particularly on team people that I've coached, that are really on teams, they're really about the game. And when the game's over, they kind of find the talking about the game kind of silly, but necessary, like, because people expect it of you. But they find it kind of silly, because one of the things we find about the phenomenon of flow in a group, and if you've ever been on a championship team or a really good team, even if you suck, if team shows up, like at a rec soccer league, when you get done, you just want to hang out together and talk about the game.
Yeah.
And it's all about the playing. It's not about winning or losing or anything other than the playing. You know, when I have the privilege of hanging out with some really good musicians here in San Francisco, and when we go out for drinks afterwards, they'll talk about aspects like, you know, MTT just did Chike 4. Probably for last time because he's retiring. And listening to them talk about each aspect of playing, when it was done, the game was over. But when they were there, it was there in the moment. So it's about the playing. It's not about anything else. And that's what you have to remove. You know, how I know I'm not going to work with the CEO or a C-level team is they go, guys, I think this is one we want to do a case study, and we're going to prove that we can turn a business out. Okay, well, this isn't about the business. It's about you. So, one, it's going to fail. Two, get away from me. Because, you know, the point would be what? It's like being a great musician in order to be well-known. Well, who wants to be? Right. If you don't like music, why are you doing that? Well, I really hate the violin. I just want to be loved by everyone. Okay, you got to love the violin a lot or you're never going to make it. But somehow in business and in other realms, we've divorced the playing of it together from the accomplishment. And we've said the accomplishment is much more important. So people want to be the guy that accomplishes rather than the guy that plays. And if you listen to, like, the quarterback from the Patriots at the end of the game, he's like, dude, you all want me to say I'm going to retire. I probably got 5 more years left. I mean, he's in insane shape, right?
Right.
my trainer tells me he is the example of what's called the supple leopard, which is the book on training. It's all about flexion and mobility and all of that. And he's like perfect. And he may have 5 more years than him at 40 years old.
Right.
So it's not about Super Bowl rings. He just loves playing. Show me that on a team. And a team of people together like that, and I'll show you a team. Versus who's taking credit. You took credit. I took credit. You're not giving me credit. All of those things that get in the way of people, you've got to get rid of that. And the thing I love about tribal leadership is it points to this is what it's like in stage 2, stage 3 team. The thing that John couldn't say or didn't put in a book, which we're at work on, you, me, and a lot of other people, is how do you transform that? How do you have the concern for my social status, my needs for myself, my financial needs, being seen to be great? How do we have that disappear for the love of the game? And that's the real work you have to do. And
well,
I
don't necessarily think it disappears, right? Because look, it's like Tom Brady loves the game. But he also has that that he does get acknowledged, right? Everyone knows, yeah, sure, Tom Brady is the quarterback of the Patriots.
Right.
You know, everyone knows, like, Warren Buffett has talked about that, like, if he lost all his money tomorrow, he would just go and just, like, you know, still be happy and do the same thing. Like, people don't believe it. But, yeah, it, you know, and Charlie Munger, I mean, the guy was bankrupt at 31 years old. Like, you know, and he loves, you know, he loves his role at Berkshire, and he loves the game of investing. And everyone knows Munger, but most people know Munger. Everyone knows Buffett. But they didn't do it for the admiration.
No.
Now, Buffett happens to like the admiration. Charlie Munger, I don't really actually think gives a shit. But the, you know, some people, if they're wired to like some admiration, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And if it feels good, and quite frankly, if you put a lot of work into something and no one acknowledges it, it can actually kind of feel a little depleting and shitty. I think it's a lot of it too is, like, if you can build an organization where there is going to be, like, people are going to give credit where it's due, but you aren't doing things just for the credit, I think that's kind of the sweet spot.
Yeah, that's very well said, Eric. That's really well said. You know, in the world of Flo and Mihai, they have this conversation of intrinsic or, well, they have a couple different terms for it, but for the love of the thing itself versus in order to get something. And as human beings, I think if you looked at Maslow, who's probably one of the geniuses of the last century, and people don't know much about what he had to say, in his hierarchy of needs, he talked about, you know, first the needs around the body for safety and food and water and all of that, and then the social needs to feel like you're a part of something, to be known, be liked, be accepted. The higher levels really are the levels where you contribute and cause things. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing wrong with the other concerns. When they're met, that's a great thing. The problem is most of the companies and most of the people inside of companies that I've seen running things, they're stuck in that middle realm called, I've never got the kind of acknowledgement, success, be a part of something, rewards. It becomes that self-gratification that runs the game, and the rest of it doesn't happen until you're 70. And then you go, oh, crap, maybe there was something more to the whole thing. So I think when you talk about Warren Buffett, you're talking about a guy who is at that self-transcendent level of where he's doing what creates value for other people in the world, and he would be doing it tomorrow if he lost every dime, because that's who he is and that's what he's doing. And there's nothing wrong with those other things too. It's great to be loved, great to be accepted, great to be admired, great to be acknowledged. When you fulfill all those things with a company, you feed them with enough money that they can live a decent lifestyle and take care of their families and send them to college. And you acknowledge people so that they be seen for what they contribute and how they're rewarded. But that's not the end of the game, where they can really identify who they are and what they're out to contribute and have a place they can do that powerfully. When that gets acknowledged and you have teams of people like that, that's how we built Lululemon. Yeah. With a very clear thing of, here's what we want to build.
Were you part of that?
Yeah, I was part
when
of
you the say team we that, how we built Lululemon. What was your role in that?
My role was a little bit cursory. I did some projects for them at the corporate level after they got started. One of my dear colleagues, Anurag Gupta, had a lot to do with how that started and what Chip started with.
Chip Wilson? Is that his name?
Yeah. Okay. He's got a book out now. And they worked really hard on, why are you doing this in the first place? Yeah. And the bottom line is, he just loves elevating things from mediocrity to greatness, to excellence. Yeah. And so he just elevates everybody's experience and everything.
I will tell you that walking into one of those stores, the people who work there are so cool.
And that's the definition of good culture right there.
Yeah.
And same thing with Disney. If you look at Disney's originating intention, it was quite simply families having magic times together. And when I've done a little work with the Disney Institute, my daughter did a internship there. They're all cast members. It's all about creating those magic times. And there's an integrity and an integration vertically and horizontally that is the essence of what we're doing here. And if you're not about that, you should probably get out because it's not going to be a fit. And then from that, teams can emerge. So it all works all different ways, but it ultimately comes back to the same thing. Competence, but there's why you're doing it and who you're doing it with and the connection there to the each other and to the marketplace. And those are the things that cause success.
Oh, one of the things I just thinking about right now is, you know, it's like when you, the recognition becomes the byproduct of the great work as opposed to doing things in order to get recognition. I mean, one of the things I like to say is like, there's the value in values, right? Like when you have businesses that are built and people are connected around, you know, core and resonant values, those businesses are just more profitable. But if you look at businesses that are trying to make money by like, we're going to have a mission statement and all of you are going to have to follow it. And if you don't follow it, we're going to discipline you. Like it actually undermines the purpose of the mission in the first place because it becomes fake. It's all in order to. Yeah.
I turned down working for a company recently that it was all in order to. Like, I have this great idea. We're going to create a mission and train everybody in it. And like we said in tribal leadership, I don't know if we said it, but here's one of the insights from the next work coming out on that, is that if you're not at a level stage four tribe, if you're not about we're all great, values make no difference, because the only value inside of I'm great and you're not, or I'm my life sucks and yours is good, and that world, the only value there is survival and ego.
Yeah.
So if you create a company that's all about survival, it doesn't matter what you put on the wall, because what's running the show is survival. Only when you get the company to a culture where it's about something other than survival, do core values, missions, or any of that crap make a damn bit of difference. You are just wasting your time if you don't get the culture to that stage four. Yeah. You know what? We're great. We're the team. And maybe it's not the best kicker in the world, but it's good enough, and we're a team, and we're great. Then values make a difference. Yeah, otherwise, there's only one value, survival.
You know, it's something that's just funny that I'm thinking about, too. It's kind of like a... So I can almost guarantee you have experienced this before, but as someone who has been in the personal development industry, if you will, whatever you want to call it, what do you call it? What industry do you say you're in? Personal development or corporate consulting? No. What do you call it?
Yes, sometimes I'll say consulting.
Okay.
Because
you're not really doing consulting much, right? Like, you're not telling. I guess you are doing some consulting, but like...
A bit. Consulting tends to be where you go in and you bring expertise that they don't have, apply it.
Right, so it's not like a perfect fit either.
The truth of what I mostly do is consciousness I frequently call it maturing people.
Okay.
Usually into who they really were before they got all screwed up. But there's development or maturing people. And then the second thing is being a thinking partner. My favorite phrase with everybody almost universally for the first 3 months I coach people is, we could do that or not, because you have to think through things. And there's so many people that aren't thinking through anything, you know, that you have to sit and be a thinking partner. Like, well, how is this going to impact things? And is that what you're really committed to? And who are we as a core business? And what is it our clients want? Those things are out the window at B school, and they don't ever come back, I don't think. So being a thinking partner and a maturity partner, bringing people along to who they really are is mostly what I do. Unfortunately, there's no name for that.
Right.
Maybe guru or something. I don't know. That's
kind
of pretentious.
Well, I was thinking for the activism that I want to be doing. The word that I invented for it was cultural activism.
Yeah, I like that.
I like that. Yeah.
Being a cultural activist.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's really great. That's awesome.
Because it doesn't, and what I liked about the word is it doesn't undermine other kinds of activism that does more like cost cutting and consulting. It's just like, we're doing the culture. And if that also means some cost cutting and consulting too, that's fine.
Yeah.
So it makes space for all of it.
Sometimes that's appropriate.
Right, correct, yeah. So, And I also like it because when you invent an when you name a field, then all of a sudden you have Monopoly in it. But and I like Monopolies.
I like that. That's good.
Yeah. What I was saying though before is people who work with other humans, right, and other people and consulting and culture and all coaching,
right?
The whatever non-word you have for it.
Yeah,
it's like hard to describe something when there isn't a perfect word for it. But
yeah,
you get the world. You get the whole world of it. Those people who are so insecure, like in some of those circles, there are people who clearly come in kind of insecure, and it becomes their new thing to hide behind, right? Where like, if all you wanted, like, imagine if someone wanted to be like a world-renowned coach, but they haven't done anything in their life, and they haven't developed themselves at all, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, like, what? Like, and those kinds of people, they just, like, it's like a lot of their conversations is all in order to think of, like, what a guru they are, how enlightened they are. And
yeah.
I've had so many situations where I'm just, like, trying to introduce myself or, like, meet one of these people. And then they like start like unsolicitedly like start coaching me in the middle of my conversation. I'm like, what the fuck, dude? Oh my god, the worst. I just want to share this story. There was one time I was at like a friend's like landmark introduction session, or maybe it was their Tuesday night forum or something. And I'm sitting kind of like outside, and I'm with my friend who just completed their forum and had an amazing time. And there's a guy that like starts talking to us and like kind of intrudes himself like in our conversation, like didn't even like ask if he could like join our group, and like whatever, like what, I don't really give a shit.
Sure.
So I'm like being friendly and trying to make a new friend. And all of a sudden he points out, he was like, you know, that lack of confidence that you show, I think you'd really benefit from doing the forum. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, okay, cool. And like, we kind of like walked away after that. The guy had no idea. Like, I've done all this, and me listening was his interpretation of me lacking confidence. It was like, huh, I'm not even going to argue that. Like, what the hell? So it's just like that to me is like the personal development version of like in the business world of the guy that like wants to prove how he's this business pioneer and, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Can I share one story of my hatred?
Sure. Please.
My personal pet peeve.
Absolutely.
I don't know if your listeners are going to like this, but here's my personal pet peeve. Like, okay. We go to dinner with people who are just finishing Wisdom 2.0. And they say, you know, oh, I'm doing this and I'm coaching and I'm a coach in this thing and that thing and business coaching. And I'm really into this mindfulness stuff and everything. And you go, oh, well, that's kind of good. And they go, oh, let me tell you all about it. And they start to describe it like somebody describing the ocean, and they didn't bother to check to find out that you've been sailing your whole life, you know?
Yeah.
And so they started talking about it, and you know, your mind is really important and you need to meditate. And you know, they start with meditation, and then at some point you go, great, and how long have you been teaching this? Well, only 6 months, and I've been doing it for a year. And you're like, oh my God, you've been into this mindfulness crap a year and you've been teaching it for 6 months. And then inevitably they ask, well, what do you do? Well, I've kind of been on this journey of mindfulness for like, I don't know, the past 46 years, and spent, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of hours with gurus and dealing with all of this stuff. But tell me more about this meditation.
But you haven't watched The Secret, and you don't know positive thinking as well as I do. You haven't learned the affirmations that I've learned.
I know, and it's like, well, this, you just need to meditate and go to yoga and find your inner chakra and, you know, get some eyeshadow for your third eye.
Honestly, you're just not positive enough.
I know.
Seriously.
So when that stuff happens, it just floors me. It's like, no, it's about empowering people to produce results and win games. It's not about closing your eyes and going away. That's not very useful when, you know, you need to put the ball in the basket. You can't go, hang on, everybody. Wait, my coach said I got a medic. No, you need to be in flow right now in the happening world where you're producing results for your shareholders. And going away isn't going to help you with that. I mean, you know, it's like step one. So there's a lot of that out there, which just drives me nuts, which is, you know, very, very basic. What you would teach a 10-year-old and then acting like that's the wisdom of the ages, right? When it's like, you know, that's the training wheels aren't even off at that point. Look, if you can't control your mind, you're screwed. That's going to take 4 to 6 months of doing a little work to learn that you're not your mind and let it go.
Yeah.
But that's step one. That's not enlightenment. That's not helpful. It's just step one. So we get this big culture out there when people talk about consciousness. And most of it's step one, which is closing your eyes and, I don't know, falling asleep or something.
Right.
So not the whole thing. So that's my personal pet peeve.
Yeah.
Is the people that remind me that I need to go to yoga, Om Allah,
watch The Secret,
eyeshadow for my third eye, and drink kombucha, wear some Birkenstocks.
I like kombucha, you know. Actually.
Oh, well, yeah, it's not that bad.
It's the reason I'm enlightened.
And you know what? I like all that stuff. I just don't like the cliched version. It's funny. I don't like
when it becomes someone's identity is where it gets obnoxious.
Yeah. Our movie, We Rise Up, just came out at Sundance a couple weeks ago. And I was with one of the people in it, Sean, can't think of her last name, runs a big yoga studio in L.A. And I love her expression of it. She was like talking to her dad about, well, I'm not good at business. I'm not good at that. And she just looked at the whole audience and said, but you know, I figured out I can pray like a motherfucker. And I was like, wow, okay. And everybody kind of laughed. I was like, well, all right, well, there you go. But she was great and active, and it was out in the world and keep your eyes open. And what are we standing for? What are we taking on, as opposed to the pretense of it all?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm not much for pretenders.
No.
So that's my pet peeve, is that conversation. Are you into, after an hour and a half on closing your eyes, are you into mindfulness too? Yes, only for the last 45 years. So.
I've read lots of books on it.
Yeah.
I read so much about enlightenment. It's amazing. I can tell you everything about it.
Yeah. I remember in college reading Zen Beginner's Mind, which was, you know, Suzuki was one of the first people that brought Zen to America. And the book's tiny. It's really good, but it's tiny. That was the whole point. There's not a bunch to read. Reading about Zen is like, you know, teaching people to sail by watching a video. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So effectiveness and results, I think, are really important. And I think that's a lot of what's missing in that world of consciousness. Is there are results to produce for businesses. There's an impact if you have product market fit. And lots of people get fired if you don't. And being conscious and not having some belief opinion about where the market's going, but actually base that on your experience and your data and what you're looking at and your wisdom and intellect, is the difference between big impacts that make a difference and big impacts that don't. And so if there's not a certain reality, that's why I like coaching professional sports, or like the guy in Formula One. You know, there's got to be a certain reality to performance, or else you're just kidding yourself.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yep.
Huh. What do you think about everything they're doing in Formula One right now? I mean, are you following that much?
No, I don't. It's been about 10-15 years where I coach somebody in Formula One.
Okay.
He's kind of interesting.
I've had there's a guy, Anthony Morley, who I've had on the show quite a bit, and me and him tend to drool over John Malone and the whole Liberty Media complex. So They've been involved in Formula One. There's been a lot of changes recently. But if it's been 10, 15 years, totally different now.
Yeah, the thing that struck me about Formula One in coaching a driver was there are some sports you can kind of play and not be in the zone. Right?
Oh, you weren't coaching management. You were actually coaching the drivers.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I've coached quarterbacks in the NFL. I tend to coach performers rather than the business. I like players, whatever sport it is. And business is a sport.
I kind of feel that they get it a little bit, like a lot better, actually, than people in business, because they're trained differently.
Yeah, yeah. It has to do with the feedback loop and being clear about what produces results.
Yeah.
That gets insulated. When you're running a big company like Visa, there's no feedback loop. I mean, how do you know what I do today, how it affects anything? Who could tell you? I mean, and you get insulated. It would be like climbing a mountain with mittens on.
I actually find that sometimes the people who are into certain art forms or crafts where it takes a certain level of flow and intuition, that they might be really, really amazing at what they do, but then when it comes to like the normal shit that like business people have down, they're so out of the loop that like, I don't want to say this like without sounding rude, but like I've seen like major psychosis get like created because they were so unbalanced.
Right.
And then they're dealing with a world that doesn't think like that. That's why people, for instance, who are like, oh God, am I going to even go here? I'm going to go here. The amount of nut jobs that I have, you know, thank God I'm dating a great girl right now, because I just feel like the dating world just keeps getting like worse and worse and worse as time goes on.
Yeah. But
I've dated, and I don't know, maybe like 4 women who were in like the equestrian world. And like, you know, 3 of those 4 were like batshit crazy, like batshit. And they were like amazing at equestrian stuff. Like 2 of them were training to be in the Olympics. But then when it came to like, just like basic understanding of like building relationships, they were so insane. And the way that they would, instead of like talking things out like a normal person would, it's like, I'm going to just go hang out with my horse and not deal with the world. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah, there is a certain, you know, as you drive towards people with exceptional capacity, sometimes they're very one-dimensional.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like one of my dear friends, I don't know if you know Ken, but one of my partners in training musicians, a world-class musicians, as well as kids, which I love to do. I volunteer and do it for free a lot.
Yeah.
Ken Lample, who taught counterpoint at Juilliard, just brilliant, brilliant guy. He was at the New York Center a lot. Great guy, right?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things he said, he does a lot of composing movie scores. And he got to work with John Williams one time. And he was, I said, how was John Williams? He goes, totally on the spectrum.
Crazy.
He is a composer and probably nothing else. He can do nothing else. Like somebody needs to handle him. It was very interesting. So I find a lot of people that are very highly effective at some things, but not others. And that's frequently in the digital world here, just because somebody's super bright on technology doesn't mean that they know how to run a business. Just like in martial arts, my sensei was a great martial artist, but he couldn't run a business to save his life.
So hold on 1 second. This is where I'm going to edit things out for a second, but I need to plug in my laptop because this has been going on a while. So hold on 1 second. Okay, I'm back. You can keep talking.
Yeah, so I've noticed the same thing that effectiveness and competency in one realm doesn't give you effectiveness and competency in another. You know, at the intersection of a couple realms, business happens to have, you know, be tough because you have to understand markets and finance and a little bit of that. But you also need to understand people, and you also need to understand the underlying art, whether it's computers, whether it's football, whether there's a human component to it. There's a logical business component to it, relationship to market. And then there's the actual thing itself.
Yeah.
I find most people can do one. If they're lucky, you can do one. But having effectiveness in doing them all is very rare. That's why you need a good team and balance a portfolio of thinking capacities and styles. But you got to be committed to people. Otherwise, you forget that they're not machines. And just the value of the thing itself isn't sufficient. You have to have the other two to be successful. And
tough when business school, you know, they don't say this directly, but they're teaching people to view others as commodities and machines.
Yeah, it's in the background, which is the contextual.
You're a cog in the machine. They don't say that directly, but that's what's in the background.
Yeah, is all the assumptions of the industrial age, right? Mm-hmm. Which is people are fungible, they're parts in a machine, you can swap them out, their capacities. Everything in the HR world has turned people into commodities and capacities so that their humanity is removed and they're an H105-6 director who does blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's just, it's ludicrous.
It's blown me away how HR departments, when they deal with issues, like internal issues, just how bad some of these guys are at dealing with people. And it's like, human relations and you don't know how to deal with the humanness of people. Like, what the fuck? Like,
well, notice the name of HR is human resources.
Yeah.
So there's computer resources, financial resources, and human.
Yeah.
You've turned it into a commodity. The kiss of death is when somebody.
Yeah, but I just said human relations. I was thinking investor relations.
Yeah. The kiss of death for me when anybody says, oh, you should work with our company. Let me introduce you to HR department. And it's like, if you have one, you should shoot it. They're only good for compliance.
Yeah.
Oh, we do a lot of training in HR. Why do you do training in HR? Those people are horrible.
Right.
It's a really tragic, tragic area where smart people go to die and stupid people excel. Because it's all about, again, it's all about that world of career concerns, which is keeping things staying.
It's not rocking the boat.
And compliance.
It's and also, no surprise, the amount of innovators that I have spoke to who either were kicked out of the business they're working at or they left because it was getting so miserable for them. And they always had horror stories about HR and the way that HR dealt with them. And it was always shut your mouth, comply, stop rocking the boat. Yeah. You piss this person off. We need to do all this political shit now. Like, and it's like, okay. And you wonder why that person doesn't work for you anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's really, really, really kind of like frightening.
How do you solve that problem in the corporate world with like just how?
Which problem's that? Like have innovation.
How do you have an HR department that is more of like? Because I guess in my ideal world, right, there isn't anything inherently bad about HR. Like if HR was more of like someone like you coaching people to like work things out, that would be way more awesome. Like dealing with the humanness of an organization as opposed to it just being a compliance thing to deal with like the Civil Rights Act or something.
Yeah. I think there is a, you know, as a former lawyer, I can tell you there are legal concerns.
Sure.
And, you know, like working at PayPal, there are regulatory concerns that you have to keep. And having run a publicly traded company, you know, regulatory concerns are a very important thing because we don't want to end up in jail. Right.
Right. Yep.
You know, it was like my SEC lawyer said, if you say something, it better be true or we all go to jail. And I was like, yee! You know,
well, that's why the whole thing with Elon of the fund secured was such a big deal. Like, you don't say that shit.
It's funny because when he said that, I went, oh, dude, his lawyer's going to freak the hell out. You cannot say anything. I think the trick to that.
Yeah, I'm not saying to bypass like whatever regulations you're dealing with. I'm just saying to like have it not be about that. Because then to me it becomes like this is what I've seen in organizations, right?
Yeah.
You want to comply with the Civil Rights Act, right? That's just like a basic like anti-discrimination laws, right? Like you want to comply with that. You don't want to be sued for firing someone because of the color of their skin or the fact. Whatever their sexuality is or something like that, right? Like, I don't even want to talk about that because I think that's just, like, an understood thing. What gets me is when people get so obsessed about not breaking that, you know, what you said kind of be construed as racist. I think you need to get some training in being more aware of your white privilege. You know, or like, just something like that where it gets so over the top that you end up just pissing people off. Like that to me, it also becomes a race to the bottom where I think everyone knows that especially if you work in a large organization, you know that one or two people that they're so not responsible for their own internal state that they will just, they will find a way to be the victim at the first moment. And the moment you say something of like, yeah, that person was discriminating against me because I'm black. I'm like, wait, what? And like, yeah, you have to take that concern seriously. But when you start creating all your corporate policies to appease that one person, you fucking destroy everything. How do you avoid that?
Well, that's a really, really good and important question. The way I look at companies or the way I look at anything is I always look at them as a series of competing concerns. So if you study a lot of this in the world of software and business, talk about the theory of constraints, which is a really, really great set of tools to look at how companies run. And there's always a dominant constraint, right? Kind of like, think of it like a bottleneck. And in the theory of constraints, you talk about different types of constraints and where the constraints are located and what you want to do with it. Well, it's kind of the same thing as the theory of constraints. There's frequently companies have a dominating concern. Okay, so if the dominating concern is we must make money at all costs, you're going to have a horrible place to live and work. Now, some companies in this agile world do what they call the green meme, which is let's all join hands and sing Kumbaya. And by the way, nobody has to produce any results.
Yeah.
When people start talking like that, I want to jump out the window because dudes, we got to make money. We got to produce product. We've got to have product market fit. You know, joining hands and singing, you know, our customers don't care that we do that. I mean, really, if it results in better products, great. But if it doesn't, that's going to be a problem. And so the trick is, just like an algorithm, when you decide to buy a stock or buy a company, there's an algorithm that needs to be running in your mind, an equation that you're balancing. As a lawyer, I look out when I was looking at cases, and I would balance all these different concerns or factors.
Yeah.
When I would take a case as a plaintiff, or I did a lot of civil rights litigation.
Okay.
And a lot of financial rights litigation.
It's funny I just brought up civil rights then.
And I was a champion in the LGBT community before there was one.
No. Oh, wow.
I've had a big history. There's a reason I'm here in San Francisco. I very much care about people, but I very much care about businesses making products and money.
Yeah.
So what you get is that those things aren't necessarily competing against each other. In each one, you have to balance it and be responsible. So are there compliance concerns? Well, yeah. Like an example I can share about is when I was at PayPal, you know, some of the guys were like, yeah, let's use Google Docs or yeah, let's use Trello. And I'd have to go, okay, why? Well, it's much easier and quicker. Got it. And if the dominant concern was ease and quickness, I'd say, yeah, that's a great idea. Have you guys ever looked, is any of this secure? Because technically we're a bank. I mean, we're not a bank, but the regulation is we're a bank. It's got to be all secure.
Right.
And then they looked and went, oh, crap, anything on Google Docs belongs to Google. Yeah. Did you know that? And people were like, no, we thought it was listen. And then we started looking at Trello. And I love Trello as a tool. It's a wonderful thing with the Kanban boards. You can make them in the Kanban boards. And then you have to realize that none of it's secure, that people get to look at that. And then they were like, oh. So we have not necessarily competing, but we have things, requirements that we have to satisfy, much like sailing a boat. I can only go a certain direction. I can't go upwind. So I have to balance out how much I pull in the sheets, how much the sails are shaped, how much upwind I go, how much leeway I get. I'm balancing those things. And as a great investor, you're always balancing out a number of factors. Sometimes they call that deliberate thinking, where you're deliberating and weighing. All of law is based on deliberation.
Yeah.
We're balancing things out. And I think that's the thing that has to happen if you want companies to work. I did work with an HR department that literally created what we called a shadow management company, that literally every manager had to have an HR person there, and they were informing and getting people to inform on people and running like Gestapo tactics.
Holy shit.
I kid you not. Everybody was scared to death. They couldn't fire anybody. They couldn't do anything because they were being informed on. I've never seen anything like that. I was like, oh my God, you need to fire all these people. It's going to kill the company. Well, we're protecting the company from what? Now, having said that, I love communication and transparency. Don't be a jerk. And if you are, you'll get dealt with. And I love accountability. Like, look, watch what comes out of your mouth. And if you have some old world ideas about people, you need to mature a bit. You need to get rid of some of those things.
Yep.
People are freaking great. And stop thinking that anybody could be good or bad because of any external factor. It's just nuts. So for me, I love that communication. Those are concerns that I balance. But you got to watch out, just like the theory of constraints. If there's a dominating concern, like we must make money at all costs, I don't want to work for that company. Or we must be politically correct at all costs. I don't think I want to work for that company either.
Hey, you can even go the opposite with communication and accountability at all costs, and it gets insane in that way.
Totally. Then everybody's running around going, what did he say? Oh, jeez. You know,
let's hold them accountable. Let's hold them and we need transparency, and then everyone's business is everyone's business, and then it becomes like a gossip fest.
Yeah. And you see that happen a lot. Usually not intentionally, but it ends up that way. And that's how that company ended up.
I think it starts quite righteously. It starts as an honorable thing. If we're going to have a very open and honest and accountable and transparent organization, and that can also degrade too if certain respect boundaries don't get put down.
Yeah, and the fun thing is, so I always think in terms instead of this is where I'm going to diverge from everybody who's listening.
It's all right.
It's funny. Instead
our two
of
listen, world, you know, if one of our two listeners right now. One of our two listeners leave right now, then we have our one committed listener.
There you go. so many things that are like that are very intimate rather than huge. So coming up with huge things to say to a company with 20,000 people, thou shalt not do this or that, that if you actually have teams at the team level, they'll kill that off in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. They'll sit somebody down and go, dude, I don't know who you think you are, but what kind of things you say gets in the way of us working together and gets between people. If we're going to be a team, we have to be all for one and one for all and nothing between us. And if you say sexist or racist things, we are going to let you know right away, dude, not cool. And I watch my kids, you know, the kids in the 20s and your generation.
Yeah.
They look at each other and go, dude, not cool. Knock that off. And they'll go, oh, okay. And they do. It's so when you have it at the team level,
and it's also set out of love too, not as like a way to discipline someone. Like I have a friend of mine, and she grew up in a very very rural part of the United States up in Maine, and she recently moved, you know, slightly downstate and still to my standards rural, but. To her, it's, you know, everything, right? And she's like the nicest person, right? She loves people, and like there's no racist or homophobic bone in her body. And she said something to me a few months ago when I was like, yeah, you know, I just got this new job, and I've actually one of my coworkers, I get to work with a homosexual, and I'm like, I really hope you're not just like going around saying I'm working with a homosexual.
Yeah.
Like the person's gay. Who cares? And she's like, what do you mean? What did I say? Well, it shouldn't be a big deal that you're working with someone who's gay. And to say I'm working with a homosexual is like saying I'm working with a Negro. It's not cool. Like that would not. And she's like, it's like that. I'm like, yeah.
One of my dear friends from Landmark, who's very big in the world of, you know, what formerly has been called inclusion, we now actually have a different name for it. So, you know, instead of inclusion and, you know, you'll be the director of diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's like old hat. I'm going to tell you and your listeners the new phrase, intersectionality.
Okay.
That's what it really is. It's at the intersection of things.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like diversity. It's literally intersectionality. And so one of my dear friends that had been around the transformational conversations at Landmark and other places, part of what she developed is a course for people where people shared with people, look, here's the terms in this community that we like. And this has been 3 or 4 years because people don't know how to speak about things. So instead of learning what they do, shut up because they don't want to get in trouble. So you had a lot of people who, you know, we've sat down and said, okay, now the doors are shut and we've collected all the phones. Let me tell you what, you people need to stop this. Here's how people want to be spoken of from this culture. This is how they want to be. And then people go, oh, well, why didn't somebody train me in this? I didn't know what to say. I didn't mean to offend people.
Right,
I just have no idea. Now that maybe is like 30% of people. Now some people are just horrible, right?
Yeah.
But there's a large group of people, especially here in the Valley, who just don't know. Like, you know, I had somebody talk to me the other day about, well, there's only two genders. Are there? Okay. You know, welcome to 1950. You want to think through that one just a little bit more. But the maturing of the language and the maturing of the conversation and relationships, if you're going to shine a bright light on it, make everybody bad and wrong, then what you've done is drive it underground. And really, you got to bring it up and say, okay, it's time to train everybody. And the same thing they used to do with, you know, HR. It's like, okay, we're going to train you on what it looks like to be a really great human being and things that aren't so great. And you may be unconscious. So right. They even have the, you know, Mark Rads runs the Institute at Stanford on non-conscious bias. And it's like, well, bias comes with humans. So you learn to be aware of it and be responsible. So what you're saying is exactly right. Rather than treat it as a litmus test, how do we make people wrong and get hysterical?
Yep.
The question is, how do we train and help people so that they see those things and can consciously let go? Because there's nothing as beautiful as two people together working on something. People, once they connect as humans, it's just brilliant. Yep. It's getting them to connect. All that stuff disappears usually.
Well, so, yeah, and it's the vilification of you saying something that it's like you're the moral, you know, you're the morality police, and if you say something that doesn't fit to my standards of what's okay, then I'm going to vilify you.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are going to be some people who, like, they just genuinely, like, hate African-Americans and they think that they, like, should be horrible. But, like, that's not the vast majority of people. Like, the KKK is, like, an organization in, like, severe decline that is pretty much a joke to most people. And I can't stand when people are like, well, if this happens, then the KKK is going to come back and everyone's going to be racist and it won't be safe for everyone and I need my safe space. And it's like, holy shit, dude. There's like 300 KKK members in this entire state. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And there's a lot of hysteria around, too, about, you know, oh, there's hordes of people coming to our country to kill us. Well, you're more likely to be killed by a falling brick from a skyscraper than somebody coming from another country.
Well, you know, during the whole war on terror, which I guess could technically still be going on depending on your definition, but when it was really insane under Bush and I guess maybe some extent under Obama too, I remember like explaining to someone that you had like there are more people that die of like getting killed by like a hammer or like getting killed by like a peanut butter allergy than they would from like getting dying of a terrorist attack. Like it's like fuck you. Like
Yeah, it's why I like to do. I'm doing a little work with one of the companies trading driverless cars.
Yeah,
and you know, more people are killed by car wrecks every year than most of the wars we've had. It's crazy if you find out how many people are hurt or injured in a car wreck, mostly due to inattention. Mm-hmm. And it's like, really, but we're going to be all, you know, let's spend $5 billion on something, you know, like a wall that you know we can easily beat with a $35 ladder from Lowe's. You know, all you need to get over a wall is an extension ladder.
Or a tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. But then on the other side, you know, we have tens of thousands of people being maimed and injured because of inactivity. But we're okay with that. We're okay with car wrecks. It's fine. I can get hit by a car and that's fine. But God help me, the five people that are killed by someone from another country, we need to spend billions on that. How about we just spend that money on, you know, things that will make it ever. So I think, you know, with the hysteria, there's two things. There's the reactive hysteria.
There's a simple answer to what you're saying right? You know, Charlie Munger always talks about the power of incentives and that even though he sees it over and over again, he still gets like shocked by it every time of how powerful incentives are. And all I'm going to say is that in politics, the incentives are different than what they say they are. There's an incentive to talk about a wall than to do something that's more logical.
Yes.
So anytime something seems weird or seems strange or is like, huh, that's a little off, it's probably not actually as strange as it looks when you understand the root forces and root causes and incentives behind what you're seeing on the surface.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly true in Compass as well. Why didn't we do this? This was a much better idea. Oh, because Bob wanted to keep his org going and get a bonus based on how many people. So we're going to do this lame-ass old tech project because Bob gets paid rather than instead let's shift over to this new pro. I've seen projects that are terminally old get green-lighted and funded for 2 years when it's going to be of no value. $100 million spent. And you're like, where did that money go? Well, but we wanted to keep Bob around. Well, how about put him on something else?
Yeah. Well, look at public companies, for instance. One of the scariest things that I've seen that just like this is like a low hanging fruit like red flag is when a CEO's salary is tied to earnings per share.
Yeah,
and it's like fuck if that's the only measure that you're looking at, then just go buy back stock at any price and you'll increase earnings per share. It doesn't mean you created shareholder value.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I have gone into companies where I've consulted and talked to executives and they literally have the ticker running on their desktop and their conversation is, well, you know, share value is up. Really? So is the temperature. You know,
At Enron, they used to have the ticker symbol like in the stock price inside the elevator.
Yeah,
I actually have an Enron code of ethics somewhere around my house.
Oh yeah, and it's all about integrity. And that's what happens when you take good people and tell them they need to make 40% profit. They just start lying and cheating and stealing.
Yeah,
and that's every company too. So the drive for we must make 40% return.
At what cost? At that point.
Yeah, well, people are going to lie, steal, and cheat.
Yeah,
that's what happens. And I think that's, again, one of the big drivers. If you balance the series of concerns across an enterprise and you look at definitely having a concern for marketplace and value and people's experience of creating value, you end up with sustainable, long-driving companies that are connected to the market that'll make money. But if one of those things goes off, it can spin out of control really badly.
Yeah.
And if I were an investor, you know, I understand why Warren Buffett says some of the things he says about companies. Like, wow, if I didn't want to work there, or if I didn't believe in her product, I just wouldn't buy it. Because at some point, the fact that you're making money makes me nervous because I don't see the value.
Well, I get nervous when I see a CEO. You know, it's one thing for an organization to just somehow magically pull a rabbit out of a hat. But when it keeps happening quarter after quarter after, I'm like,
dude. Yeah, that's where you end up with Bernie Madoff.
Right, yeah.
You're making what? I had somebody tell me the other day, oh, I get all my money back in 2 years, and with a $200,000 investment, I make a 40% per year. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's not going to happen. So, you know, and then, you know, what happened, you know, 6 months later, checks in.
Can you hold on 1 second?
Well, invest.
I'm getting a knock on the door. Hold on a second. Having a filter replaced in my
house. Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, so these guys these guys are the owners of my apartment that I rent. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
They're wonderful people, too.
I've actually got to get my son to his he's going to try out a new bassoon.
Oh, wow.
Today. Yeah, he may want to buy it. It's only about $45,000.
I had a friend back in high school. His dad is like one of the most famous. Might have been
what his name was.
What's that?
Wonder what his name was.
I don't remember his last. Anyway, yeah. I've met him before in San Francisco because I've been at his house.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah.
No kidding!
Like years ago. Right. Yeah,
that's a small world.
Yeah,
yeah. That's who my son's studying with.
And no way.
He's a god. I mean, he's like crazy good.
Yeah. So actually, I'm gonna keep this off the air.
Yeah. All right.
Well, this was great. It was a pleasure having you on the show.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. So. All right. Well, you're always welcome back. And
well, thank you.
Yeah. And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to reach you?
They can reach me through LinkedIn. Obviously, that's how a lot of people
in the show notes, I'll put a link to your LinkedIn.
Yeah, they can friend me on LinkedIn or they can find me at my email address, which is scott@b-un.com.
That's b-un.com.
Yeah, b-un, b-1.
All right.
Yeah, that's the two ways to catch me. Everybody here looks at LinkedIn. It seems like that's kind of the thing here in the Valley. That's how everybody finds
It's an easy way to do it.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I'll be here.
All right.
It's been an absolute joy being with you. This has been more of the fun conversation, looking at different things. It's wild. It's the first time I've done a podcast, and this was a ball.
Oh, right on. Well, hope
you make it really fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. All right. Well, have a great day.
All right. You too.
See ya.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.